Hello, and welcome to the London Writer Salon podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Parul. And each week we sit down with a writer that we admire to talk about the craft of writing and the art of building a successful and sustainable writing career.
These interviews are recorded live with our global writing community. If you would like to join us for the next recording or write with us at our daily Writer's Hour writing sessions, head to londonwritersalon.com for more information.
If you want to know about attention and focus, Dr. Gloria Mark has been a leader in this field for decades. In this interview, we talk about her research into deep work and focus and the process of writing her book, Attention Span, a groundbreaking way to restore balance, happiness, and productivity. We talk to Gloria about the different attention states, how we might get into an artistic flow, and why empty space in our days is so important. She says, when you think about a Japanese garden, you think of the beautiful rocks that are placed there, but it's the space around those rocks that's actually really important and as carefully considered as the rocks themselves. She goes on to say, consider empty space in your day to be as important as the work you're actually doing, because it helps you prepare and enables you to do this kind of deep work. We cover a lot of ground in our chat, so let's begin. We hope you enjoy our conversation with Dr. Gloria Mark.
And if you're loving these conversations and want to help support the podcast, please rate and review us wherever you listen to us. Each month, we give away prizes to our reviewers, things like mugs and stickers and other goodies. Plus, it's just a nice way to show us your love and to help keep us going. Thanks so much for listening. Welcome to the London Writer Salon, Dr. Gloria Mark.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're so pleased to have you here. And a little fun fact before we begin, and Gloria, I hope you don't mind me sharing this, but I just found out a couple of days ago, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. Gloria's from Cleveland, Ohio. But not only that, Gloria went to high school with my mother. So I just had to share that. And so this makes it extra special. And going back to childhood, did you have a relationship with writing as a kid?
You know, I didn't really write that much, although the first thing that I actually wanted to do was to be a journalist. So I guess it was just because I thought being a reporter would be very glamorous, but that didn't pan out. So I never became a journalist.
And maybe for the best, because you maybe wouldn't have gotten into your wonderful and important work. But even before we get into that work, so you wanted to start your career as a journalist, but you did actually start your career, at least you studied as an artist, and then later changed career paths to be a psychologist. Can you tell us, why did you shift away from art?
Yeah, so, well, I went into art because I loved it, and I couldn't imagine doing anything more creative. What I didn't consider was, you know, what do you do with an art degree when you graduate? And I was fortunate in that I was able to do some work with the Cleveland Area Arts Council, while I was still a student. But then I graduated and I saw that the most talented artist friends of mine were working these 8-hour a day jobs doing something else to support their art. And I thought, I can't do this. You know, that's just not, I'm not driven enough to be able to spend 8 hours a day doing something that I didn't particularly care for to support art. So then the question is, what can I do? I was pretty good at math and science. So I thought, well, maybe I can find a career in that. Fast forward, I was hired as a research assistant at University of Michigan. I went there to get a master's degree. And to his credit, Dr. Manfred Cochin gave me a job, but he almost didn't because he asked, well, what can you do? He was an information scientist, had never heard of this field, had no idea what this meant. And he asked me, can I code? Do I know network theory? And I kept saying, no, no, no. And then he finally said, what can you do? I said, well, I can paint, I can draw. And I started to walk out the door. And he said, wait a minute, come back. And he told me before he went to MIT to do his PhD, he studied at the Art Students League in New York. And he said, you know, research is a risk, and I'm going to take a risk with you. Can you study the discovery process of artists. And I said, oh, sure, I can do that. I knew what it was like to make a discovery. I had no idea how you write it in scholarly terms. And so that's what started me on the path to psychology. I started reading up on all this work, and I later went to Columbia University and did a PhD in psychology.
An incredible journey. I'm so glad that he took a risk on your background and you've applied that to the field you're in now. So now your research area is human-computer interaction. You study how people interact with technology, things that we all know about and talk about, things like multitasking, attention, mood, stress, things that we grapple with. And I imagine you're in high demand these days. And you say, rather than bring people into a laboratory to study them, I go where people are. The real world becomes a living laboratory, which sounds fascinating to us. And we're curious, for us, for the writers in the room, for the layperson, what does your living laboratory look like?
Yeah. So, you know, traditionally what psychologists do is they bring people into a laboratory. And, you know, a laboratory is a simulation of the real world, right? But it can't possibly simulate everything that people experience, right? It can't simulate people's stress or their conflicts or their career trajectories. There are so many things that you just can't reproduce in a laboratory. So I use various kinds of methodologies, mostly sensors and computer logging techniques, ubiquitous technologies, so that I can study what people are doing with their devices in the course of their real lives, their actual work environments, their home environments. And using sensors allows me to do it. And then I can capture just the full range of people's lived experiences as they're using their devices.
And I'm curious, in the book, you talk about how in the earlier days, you'd stand behind someone with a stopwatch and see how long they'd spend on a task. So imagine the technology has changed dramatically for you over the years.
It has. I mean, I was always interested to use very objective measures to get, you know, really good, solid empirical data. And, you know, when we first started doing this back, this actually started in 2003, there really weren't computer logging techniques that we could use. So yes, we shadowed people, had these, you know, stopwatches, very laborious, you know, took a long time to get data. It was accurate, but, you know, it doesn't scale the way that computer logging techniques do.
So you've spent around 30 years studying these things, attention, focus, the relationship between humans and technology. And technology has radically changed and evolved over those 30 years, which is fascinating. You've published over 200 papers. And before we begin digging into the book and your work, what drives you to do this kind of work? Like, why is it attention and focus? And I imagine it's something beyond accolades and fame and all those good things. Why does this topic matter to you personally?
It's driven by my own interest, right? If I wasn't interested in this, I wouldn't do it. If I do any kind of research project, it's because I just have a deep inherent interest in it. This particular topic of attention came about from my own experience. So I had been working and living in Germany until the year 2000, and then I came to the U.S., started in academia as an assistant professor. And, you know, my life changed radically, you know, changed countries, changed jobs. One of the consequences of changing jobs is that I was suddenly handling so many more projects than I had in my work in Germany. I worked at a research institute, and I found my attention just shifting between all these different projects. I was trying to handle multiple deadlines, trying to prioritize. And I found it very hard to keep my attention focused on any one particular thing, mostly because there were multiple deadlines that I had to try and take care of. But at the same time, I found it very hard to pull away from the screen. I found myself being glued to my computer, and I was on my computer excessively quite a long time. This was before smartphones, right? We had these flip phones. So that was even before smartphones. And I was, you know, glued to my computer. And I thought, Is it just me or other people have the same kind of experience? And I started talking with people and everyone else said, yeah, I just have a really hard time focusing. And then I thought, well, I can study this empirically. I can ask a research question: to what extent are other people experiencing difficulty in focusing? You know, the digital age is upon us, right? It's rising fast. So that's what started me off on this.
Mm. And your book, it came out in January, and we've got a bunch of questions around that. But you were publicly sharing some of this information. I mean, we read an article as early as 2006, an interview on Gallup's site. I'm sure there are many, many others. But it seems like there's a choice as an academic to either write within your fellow academia community or begin to disseminate your ideas and research to a non-academic audience, a popular audience, a layperson audience like us. When did you decide, actually, I want to share these things with the public instead of just keeping it insular within the academia community?
Yeah, so it actually started, I mean, there was an idea that was slowly incubating in me that I wanted to write a trade book, but I never really had the time for it. And I was just, you know, speaking to an academic audience. That's what I was used to. And then I got a call. It was a cold call from an agent. And she introduced herself and asked if I'd be interested to write a popular book, or a book for a popular audience, I should say. And I said, well, I'm kind of thinking about it. She had used my work in her graduate program. So she knew my work very well. And she said, you know, I think your work would fit very well to a popular audience. I thought about it. The pandemic hit. That was around, what, March 2020. I talked to a really good friend of mine. He had worked at Google. He had just written a book. He said it was a really great experience. And so I talked to his agent, got some more information, and then I decided I'll just plunge in and do it.
Well, we have a question around if it was as fun as your friend said it was. So we'll get into that later. But first, I think this is a nice time to turn to your book. The book is called Attention Span, A Groundbreaking Way to Restore Balance, Happiness, and Productivity. It came out in January. We've got a bunch of questions around the topics of the book and how it can relate to us as writers and creatives. But you already talked about the idea for putting this into a book. What's your hope for the book?
I hope that it can actually help people gain more agency, more control in their attention. Because, you know, I have studied people over the years. I've talked with so many people, hundreds of people, or, you know, maybe even more, because I've talked to audiences, all kinds of audiences. And people have told me that this is a real problem for them. And I'm also really concerned with stress. Stress is really an epidemic, not just in the US, but globally. And I'm really interested in what we can do to try to control stress, how the use of our technologies contributes to stress, what we can do about it. So I'm hoping that people can, well, actually, two things. Number one, that they can actually learn about the science behind their short attention spans, which I think is really important for people to gain a deep understanding of what's happening every time they go on a screen. And number two, I hope that they can actually change, right? That they can become more intentional in their actions and develop new behaviors that are a lot healthier and less stressful when they use their devices.
Gosh, well, we hope for that too.
We can use a lot of that, yes.
Yeah, we could use that help. I'd love to start by talking about attention states. You talk about how attention is not binary, it's nuanced. And you talk about the different attention states, which I found really interesting: rote, focus, bored, frustrated. And with that in mind, what do you think we, and perhaps you define them for us, but after that, just what do you think we should know as creatives, as writers, about these states of attention?
So first of all, there's this common perception that attention just has two states: you're focused or you're unfocused. And, you know, when I was studying this, I realized that there's different ways of paying attention. We can be very engaged in something and it involves a lot of mental effort. So if I'm trying to read tax law, which I try to avoid doing, in fact, my husband is very good at that. So that's a relief for me. But if I'm trying to do something effortful, you know, I have to pay attention. It's very challenging for me. But you can also be very engaged with something, and it doesn't involve a lot of mental effort. When you play solitaire, or for those who play Candy Crush, for those who scroll social media, you know, these are easy, engaging activities to do and doesn't involve mental effort. Of course, we can not be engaged and not be challenged, and that's bored. It's a state of boredom, right? We can be challenged and not engaged, and we call that a state of frustration. And an example is when I have a tech problem, I'm really challenged and I'm just not at all engaged in solving. It's really hard to motivate me to do it, but I have to. So I get frustrated. So the other part of your question, how can writers use this knowledge? So it's really important to understand that we can't have long extended periods of sustained focus without getting ourselves exhausted. And so this is another myth that when we're on our devices, we should try to be as focused and pack as much as we can into as long a period as possible. That doesn't work in the same way that we can't lift weights all day without getting ourselves exhausted. So we have to switch our attentional states, right? We have to do something that doesn't involve a lot of mental effort. And so then we can switch to doing rote activity, or for that matter, even being bored, but doing something that doesn't involve that much mental effort. People have, and this is really key, people have a limited amount of attentional resources. And you can think of it as a tank, right? And if you have a really good night's sleep, you start the day with a full tank, and then the tank kind of drains throughout the day. And a lot of things we do drain our tank, like long periods of sustained focus. And other things we do can replenish us. Taking a really good break can replenish us. When you go on a nice vacation, right, you come back, you just feel so refreshed. But, you know, writers need to understand that it's really important to pull back and get yourself replenished. There are things that we can do to replenish, and I imagine we'll talk about that in a bit. But when you come back to your work, then you can see it with fresh eyes. You can get new ideas. You can think of more and better quality ideas. So there's a lot of benefits for just, you know, stepping back and before you start entering into this focused attention again.
Seems like a nice reminder for the writers, for all of us in the community who maybe can be a bit hard on ourselves for not getting as much done in a writing session than we'd wanted to. And just reflecting on the writers in our community, thinking about how many of us have day jobs. So we're focusing, or maybe rote work, at work, and then trying to do writing in between. Do you have any thoughts on whether it's a different type of focus in our day job than it is for the focus we might need for writing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It really depends on what a person's day job is, you know, how interested they are in their job. The thing that makes it really tough for people who work in the evenings is that by the end of the day, your resources start getting spent and you just don't have a lot of fuel left to be able to do really good, hard, creative work. So, you know, it's tough. If you have a day job that doesn't involve a lot of strain, a lot of mental strain, it's going to be easier for you. But the other thing that happens is that from the time we wake up, our mental resources naturally drain independent of the things we're doing. In other words, the time since when we woke, we see this kind of natural slow drain of resources. So by the end of the day, we've just got a lot less than from the time that we started the day. Even if you're taking good breaks, right? It's really hard to get back to that level that we started the day with. So it's a challenge for writers. I mean, I know this well because for the nature of the work I do as an academic, for so many years, I would just work straight through in the evenings, and I worked nonstop. And I realized how difficult it was to really get good ideas and to really push myself late in the evening. You know, I was exhausted mentally.
I'm curious about duration of focus time in a day. This book that really stuck with me by Mason Curry, I think it's called Daily Rituals or Daily Routines.
Yes, great book.
Yeah, and one of the takeaways for me is that he studied from artists to inventors to scientists, is that most of them would work like 2 to 4 hours a day. Like that was their focused work day. And I'm curious if you have any findings, some research, some data that might back up or maybe be contradictory to that anecdote.
Yeah. So our data shows that there's actually two peak focus times during the day that people have. And we did this by giving people probes on their computers and on their smartphones. And they just had to answer two really simple questions. How engaged are you in the thing you're doing right now? And how challenged are you in the thing you're doing right now? And then we mapped those onto those four different attentional types that I talked about: focus, rote, boredom, challenge. And we find that if we just look at focus, states of focus, people have a peak focus time between 10 and 11 in the morning on average, and then in the afternoon again between 2 and 3 p.m. on average. So we see rhythms in focus, and that corresponds to the ebb and flow of people's attentional resources that they have. Now, the total amount of time, you know, that really depends on the individual, but I think there's a good chunk of time in the morning people might spend, could be about 2 hours in the morning, and then again in the afternoon, about 2 hours. So there are individual differences. It also depends on your chronotype, which is your own personal biological rhythm. If you're an early type, your peak focus will be much earlier in the day. If you're a late type, it'll be much later in the day. But on average, you know, we find there to be these two peak focus times.
And if someone wanted to find out what their peak focus time was, is it simply noticing, keeping a track over a couple of days?
That's a big part of it. So first of all, you can find out what your chronotype is. I would guess that most people have a pretty good idea of what your chronotype is, if you're an early type or late type. There's a survey you can take called the Morningness Eveningness Questionnaire. You can find it online. So that can start to guide you. I have had students keep diaries, and what my students did was set random timers throughout the day, and they simply marked down when they were focused, and they were able to map out their own personal rhythms of when they were focused. So you don't need a random timer. You can just, you know, maybe once an hour, a couple of times an hour, you can actually write down and note down what your level of focus is. I would do it for multiple days, and then you can go back and look at it, and you get a sense of when you're really at your peak and when you feel pretty spent.
I really like this idea of rhythm that stood out for me from the book. And there's a quote I just wanted to share where you say, just as rhythms abound in nature, our research shows that our attention also follows rhythms. And I'm curious about, for you, you spoke about how you were interrupted while writing this book. How did you find your rhythm? What did that look like for you? Or what times did you write?
Yeah, so I am not a morning person. I'm also not a late type. I'm a moderate type. But it's really hard for me to get started doing full throttle work first thing in the morning. So I do what I call subordinate work. I do email. I do smaller tasks that kind of help me ramp up. One of the reasons I do a task like email is to get it out of the way, because otherwise I'm going to be thinking about it. I wonder if someone contacted me, and that's going to serve to interrupt me. So I do it to get it out of the way. And then it's, you know, maybe 9, 10 in the morning, and then I can really get started doing focused work. And then it's really important to step back, take a really nice long break, and then I start work again. And I usually get pretty mentally exhausted late in the afternoon. And that's when I pull back and I do exercise. I try to go outside and, you know, have dinner. And sometimes I'll go back to work if I feel refreshed, if I feel like I have enough resources to do something creative.
In the book, you also make a distinction between artistic flow versus the knowledge worker rhythmic focused attention, which again was a bit of a surprise to me. Could you talk a little bit about these concepts? What is artistic flow and how is it different from focused attention?
Yeah, so the idea of flow was a term that was invented by the psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And it describes what he calls the optimal state of attention. It's where you're so engaged, you're so immersed in something that nothing else seems to matter and time just passes you by. And if you're doing work that's inherently creative, you know, like doing art or playing music, doing woodworking, even, you know, people who do sports, you can get into this kind of flow state, right? And you're just, you know, hours can go by and you don't realize it. When I was in art, I would regularly get into flow. And, you know, before I knew it, I remember as a student working in a studio and it would be 2 or 3 in the morning. And then I would realize, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I was working so long. So now working in science, it's a very different kind of mindset. I use more analytical thinking. And so it's a different kind of approach to my work than flow. It does involve focus. Every so often, I can get into flow. Usually, it's if I'm brainstorming with another person, I might get into flow. But, you know, usually when I write, I'm very consciously searching for words, trying to articulate, you know, exactly what I want to say. And that's not actually flow. The writer Maya Angelou also talked about this. And she complained about all these critics who said, oh, for writing, you know, for Maya Angelou, writing is so easy. And she said, oh, I just want to strangle these critics because I really have to work at it. You know, it's really hard work. And it doesn't mean it's not rewarding if you don't get into flow. It can be deeply rewarding and fulfilling. It's just a different way of thinking about work. And I'm not saying that people can't get into flow. It's just not as common as we think. And especially if you're in the field of knowledge work, it's really quite rare. You know, if someone is a full-time writer, you can get into flow, especially when it comes to generating ideas. But you're also spending a lot of time just trying to articulate precisely what you want to say, and you're flipping perspectives between the reader and the writer. And that's not a flow state.
I feel like that's almost giving us permission to not put so much pressure on ourselves to be in this flow state, but actually embracing writing for what it is, which is partly analytical. Now, we spoke earlier about the peak attention window and asked you about how we might identify our peak window. And you said, you know, you might keep a diary of when those times are. And I suppose the follow-on question from that is, once we've identified that, are there any thoughts on how we ramp up to, I know you spoke about emails potentially, ramp up to and then fade away from a peak state? Are there any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I want to argue to pull away from this idea of scheduling days where we try to pack as much as we can into the day. We schedule things back to back. This relates more to knowledge work than to someone who's a writer who might have a more flexible schedule. But, you know, I want us to think about designing your day. So be more intentional in how you design it and to take advantage of what your peak attention times are and to use those times to do your hardest work and the work that requires the most creativity. So as a writer, you want to use those times for putting down fresh thoughts or for thinking of new ideas. And for something like editing, you know, you might do those at times where, you know, it requires less mental effort. Although sometimes editing requires a lot of effort, depending on what stage of editing you're at. But I would say intentionally design your day to think about, you know, what's the most important work that I really want to accomplish today, and, you know, do it during those peak times that you have.
What about protecting those peak times? Because it's one thing to say, okay, here are my peak times. It's quite another to protect it from other people, other priorities, but also from yourself. And I think you write that actually we interrupt ourselves more than other people interrupt us. What have you learned around keeping sacred and firm boundaries, either in the data or maybe personally?
Yeah, it's a really important question. So you're right. We tend to blame our lack of focus on notifications or targeted algorithms. That's not the full story, right? We are just as likely to interrupt ourselves. You know, you have an urge to check the news or check social media or a memory of something that we forgot to do. And so we are constantly interrupting ourselves as often as being interrupted by something external to us. So there are things we can do. So the obvious thing, and I imagine many people already do this, is you turn off your notifications, use ad blockers, you know, get rid of those nasty things that try to capture your attention, turn off your email, turn off your Slack notifications. But we can also do things ourselves. So I can talk about an idea that came to me during the pandemic. So during the pandemic, my university offered a course in mindfulness meditation, mindfulness-based stress reduction. It was a very, very useful course. And as I started to practice this, I realized that I could use the same idea when I'm on my devices. And, you know, mindfulness is about staying in the present, you know, keeping focused and bringing your thoughts to the present. And I realized that if I'm working and I have this urge to check the news, I can probe myself and I can ask myself, why do I have this urge to check news right now? You know, will I get a benefit from it? Most of the time, it's because I'm bored or because I'm procrastinating. I don't want to work on the thing I'm working on. But the key thing about this kind of probing, and I call this meta-awareness, which means being aware of what you're doing as it's unfolding. The key thing is to make all these unconscious desires and actions that we do, to bring them into our conscious awareness. You know, an example of an unconscious action is you see your phone and you want to grab it and pick it up, right? And you recognize that and you make it conscious, make your actions more conscious, and then you can change, right? When something is in your conscious awareness, you become more intentional and then you can change.
This idea is so fresh for me because actually a couple of weeks ago, I just went on a silent meditation retreat. And it's the same thing. We're basically training our mind to concentrate, essentially, and to be quicker when you find yourself, oh, I've been thinking about this thing for 3 to 5 minutes, pull it back. And hopefully the time to pull back becomes closer and quicker. So I love that, tying those two concepts together. Let's talk about goals, if you don't mind. So in your book, you talk about the importance of goals. You say our attention is goal-oriented. When our attention is goal-oriented, we can act purposefully. And we do a monthly goal setting workshop. And at the beginning of every month, together, we set our goals for our writing for the month. But one of the things that you say, and it's something we're conscious of, is that when setting goals, we should optimize not for productivity, but for well-being, which sounds like it doesn't make sense in a way. But we're very conscious of this because we want to help people achieve the things they want to do, but we don't want at the end of the month to be the thing that you berate yourself for not doing. And I wonder if that is what you're saying there. And can you tell us a little bit more about why optimizing for well-being over productivity makes sense with goals?
Yeah. So when you have positive well-being, you can do more. We can all do more. There is a psychological theory. It's called the broaden and build theory. And what it says is that when people are positive, they have more choices for how to act. So you have a larger repertoire of actions that you can draw to take you know, if you're thinking of new ideas, you can think of more ideas, better quality ideas when you feel positive. So it allows us to simply do more. Now, in contrast, you know, imagine that your well-being is not very good. You feel really stressed. That interferes with our ability to really work and be productive, be efficient. And so let's kind of get to the root. Instead of thinking about, I want to accomplish X amount by the end of the day, let's start thinking about what I can do with my mindset to be positive, to enable me to think as clearly as possible. And then the productivity will come along the way. I did a study with Alex Williams at Microsoft Research. I've done a lot of research with colleagues there. And we used a simple conversational agent that would ask people at the beginning of the day two things. What do you want to accomplish today? So what's your task goal? And what's your emotional goal? How do you want to feel today? And people answered those two things. And it really had a benefit, right? It really enabled people to be more productive. But here's what we discovered, that it's not enough to simply ask people once at the beginning of the day, because setting goals is really a dynamic process. It's so easy for goals to slip, for us to forget our goals, for other things to interfere with our goals. So we have to keep reminding ourselves of our goals. How can we do that? You know, if you had a conversational chatbot, that would be an easy way to do it. You can write a little post-it note, you can write down on a piece of paper. Putting it down on a piece of paper creates an external memory, something that we can really refer to so that we won't forget it. But, you know, always keep those goals fresh and keep reminding ourselves and set emotional goals as well as task goals.
That's beautiful. So we shared with you before we kicked off, we do this daily writing session called Writer's Hour. And one of the things that we prompt each other is what we say, what's your intention for this hour? Which it could be your goal, could be your focus. I love the idea of the emotional. How would you like to feel at the end of this hour? So maybe something we can start implementing. But one of the things we do is at the end is then check in. Okay, how did you do? Did you do the thing you set out to do? Did you get stuck? Was it a good day, fruitful day, frustrating? And I'm curious, what have you found in the research around then checking out on that goal? And how do we keep ourselves from beating ourselves up when we either don't hit the goal or we fall short of it? Anything in your research that can help us sleep better at night would be helpful.
Yeah. Don't be hard on yourselves. That's the main thing I would say. And sometimes we set unrealistic goals. And so I just know from experience, and many other people have this experience, that you always need to allot more time to do something than you have planned. You know, if I think I'm going to finish a chapter in 2 hours, I'm going to extend that and I'm going to make it 4 hours or 5 hours. And guess what happens? You finish it and then you feel good. You feel fulfilled. Wow, I finished it. Instead of trying to pack in as much as we possibly can, you know, give yourself more time, give yourself, you know, some leeway and you'll feel so much better. And you'll probably have much better quality as well if you can be more relaxed and give yourself more time to do something. But don't beat yourself up if you don't meet your goal.
Thanks. We're going to play that recording for people as a little pep talk. Thanks, Gloria.
You also mentioned the importance of coupling goals with visualization. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why that's important. What would a solid visualization practice look like?
Yeah. So the more concrete you can make a visualization about a goal, the better able one is to follow that goal. So if my goal is I'm going to finish this book chapter, I actually have to visualize, okay, what's it going to be like to close Microsoft Word and finish that up and think about what I'll do afterwards, right? The more concrete your visualization is, the better. And in fact, that relates to another idea, which is practicing forethought, which also relates to goals, but also helps to keep us on track what does practicing forethought mean? It means imagining our future selves and how our current actions will impact our future selves. Now, what makes the most sense is think of your future self at the end of the day. And, you know, if I have an urge to check news, I'm a news junkie, I practice forethought and I think about what's my life going to be like at 10 o'clock in the evening? Am I going to be feeling fulfilled and rewarded that I accomplished what I set out to do and I'll be relaxing and have a nice glass of wine? Or am I still going to be working on that book chapter or that overdue report? So the more concrete you can make that visualization of your end of the day, the better able you are to resist your current urges to check news or social media, and the better able you are to really stick to your plan.
I like that forethought. And it sounds like this is what you're talking about, thinking about your future self at the end of the day. You're touching also upon what you call emotional valence, so the emotional quality associated with the actions that you plan on taking that day. Is that right?
Yes.
Most ruminating.
Yes.
And I'm curious about if you were to plan a week ahead and you're thinking about all the different activities that you have to do, some of them may be necessary, but perhaps a bit more tough on us. There might be some negativity associated with it. How do you think about balancing that out? I don't know if this is too simple a question, but there are some things we have to do that are hard, that are tough, that are stressful or frustrating. Any thoughts or tips on how we can balance it out?
Yeah. So, you know, unfortunately, life deals us hard tasks as well as things that we'd love to do. And so I would think about doing something that can make you feel positive after you do some difficult kind of task. So, you know, in my world, if I'm going to be at a meeting that I know is going to be a really tough meeting, you know, we're going to have a difficult decision, or maybe I'm going to be with someone who's going to be a bit tough to deal with, I will plan something afterwards so that I can feel positive. And maybe it's even a break. Don't schedule another difficult meeting or difficult task right after that. But, you know, take it easy on yourselves and do something that can improve your well-being. And don't feel the pressure like you have to, oh my gosh, I did this horrible task. I feel terrible, but I have all this other work and all these other deadlines, and let me plunge right into those. Step back, take a break, replenish your attentional resources, because you won't perform well if you don't have good well-being. And if you're just exhausted from some really difficult task and you feel very negative, do something to refresh yourself.
Love it. We've touched on so much, Gloria. And I think a lot of people are writing notes. I know I can't wait to re-listen to this so we can write some notes for myself and ourselves. We've talked about probing. We've talked about attention. We've talked about rhythms and goals, emotional states. Is there anything that we haven't covered yet that you think your work or your book is especially important for us to know as writers?
Mm-hmm. I guess one thing to keep in mind is that we live in this broader, what I call a socio-technical world. And that means that it's not just our own lack of willpower that makes it hard for us to focus. And we often blame ourselves, but to understand that we don't use technology in a vacuum. And there's all kinds of other influences on our attention that we should understand that contribute to making it difficult for us to focus. Of course, people know about targeted algorithms and notifications. The internet itself was designed to distract us with the node and link structure. It maps on so well to how human memory is organized. We think in terms of associations. And every time we go on the web, there's so many entry points into our mind's network. And we go back and forth from clicking on links, and it's setting off just a firestorm of associations. And it's very easy to go into a rabbit hole. Even the way that social media is designed for us to consume it in short snippets, to snack on it, this also contributes to short attention spans. And for that matter, even film and TV, we know that shot lengths have decreased over the years, and they now average 4 seconds for every shot length. So there's a number of different influences on us. We're social beings. You know, it's natural for us to seek social awards, to be drawn to social media and even email for that matter. So again, don't blame yourselves because you feel you have lack of willpower. Some people were born lucky with, you know, really good self-regulation skills, but a lot of people weren't. And it doesn't mean you can't change, right? You can change, but, you know, understand that there are many other influences going on in our world, our digital world, that affect attention.
Thank you for that context. And we definitely recommend your book for anyone who wants to go deeper into understanding all the different forces that act upon us as we try and focus on many things.
Oh, there was another thing I just realized, and this actually ties back to an earlier question you had, which is talking about how we can plan our day. And there is this Japanese concept, which is called Yohaku no Bi, which means the beauty of empty space. And when you think about a Japanese garden, right, you think of the beautiful rocks that are placed in a Japanese garden. But it's the space around those rocks that are just as important and are as carefully considered as the rocks themselves. It sets the rocks off to make them visually beautiful. When I studied art, I learned it was not just the figure that I was creating, but the space around the figure was as important to really enable that figure to shine. That's called empty space or negative space. When you design your day, intentionally design in empty space. This is time to replenish, right? It's time for you to build up your attentional resources. You can contemplate, meditate, take a walk in nature. If you can't get outside, you know, move around, or for that matter, even do some simple road activity that calms you, right? And people report all kinds of road activity. But consider empty space in your day to be as important as the work you're actually doing, because it helps prepare you and enable you to really do this kind of deep work.
It's definitely something I needed to hear. So my challenge to myself and to anyone else listening who faces this is, let's find some empty space in the days to come and see how that affects our work and our happiness. I think now we'd love to turn to your writing practice and process. I'm really curious about how you've written this book. So your book is divided into 3 parts. And I'm curious about whether you outlined that right from the start or whether that came later on.
So it came fairly early on. I definitely wanted to cover the research, but then I felt that wasn't enough, right? I wanted to give an understanding of how we're positioned in this broader socio-technical world. Like what's happening in the digital world? And I felt it was really important to include a section on that. And then the third part, which is the path forward, how can we gain agency? I also thought I can't just talk about the research or, you know, how we're positioned in the world without actually providing some kind of solution. Now, there was some shuffling going on, because in the second part of the book, I have a chapter on our social, the fact that we're social creatures and how that affects our behavior. I also have a chapter on personality and a chapter on the role of emotion when we use our devices. Those chapters kind of flipped around. The emotion chapter ended up in part one, talking about research, because there is some research there. So did the personality and social chapter. So there was some shuffling going on before it kind of finally settled. So just to sum up, I think the basic structure of 3 parts came fairly early, and then the details of what went into those kind of settled as the writing process continued.
Was it clear to you from the start what the through line was? Did that develop as you were writing?
It's really an iterative process. And I can't honestly say that it had occurred to me from the very beginning, but what I tried to do was to make it work. You know, I had these ideas, for example, talking about targeted algorithms, talking about film and TV. How can I make that work? How can I fit that in with the rest of the book? That was a challenge because those kind of seemed a little bit separate, but I felt that they were really important to include as well. So it's always a challenge to try to include topics that you really think are important, but they may not connect so well to the other things.
I'm curious how much you or your agent or editor thought about the market that you were publishing in, looking at comparisons, trying to understand your place where you'd sit on the bookshelf.
Yeah, they thought quite a bit about that. So there are other books on talking about attention in the digital age. But what they said, these other books were done by journalists or technical writers. And what they told me was, you know, I'm the one that's done the research. And so I'm the, you know, so-called authority, the person who's actually been in the trenches for all these years doing the research. I have been interviewed by other technical writers and journalists for their books, right? But my editor and agent said, yeah, but you're the source. You're the one who actually did the work and can give us a behind the scenes look at it. So that's what they were thinking about in terms of positioning it.
Just one final question on the writing of it before I turn over to Matt. How many drafts did you go through? Do you have any sense, or is it quite difficult to add that up?
I went through so many drafts. So first of all, the actual proposal that was sent out to editors was quite long. It was like 80 pages. So it was like a third of the book. And even getting to that point, there were many, many drafts. I wrote the chapters individually. And what I tried to do was that I would set a goal to finish this one chapter. And I had a good starting basis from the proposal. So I had about a third of the chapter that I could work with, right? I had the structure for the chapter. And I also had a lot of material that was taken out of the proposal that I could look at and decide whether to put that back in. And so, yeah, I went through many, many drafts for the individual chapters. Then when it was all put together, I talked about the reshuffling of different chapters to make it work. And then there were a few more iterations of the entire draft.
Mm. We love this stuff. You talked about being positioned as the authority, that on the shelf, you're the one that's been doing all these years of research. Looking at you, I can't imagine you would feel any ounce of imposter syndrome to assume that role. But I'm curious, as that was the way this was being positioned, were there any self-doubts that entered or any imposter syndrome or any of those challenging thoughts as you wrote and tried to get prepared for publishing this book?
Oh, it's rare to find someone who does not experience imposter syndrome, especially in academia, right? It's very easy to, certainly in academia, I experience imposter syndrome. But I think in terms of the writing, I didn't experience imposter syndrome for the writing of the book. Why? Because I have the work behind it, right? You know, I feel like I've been in the trenches. I'm writing from, you know, having been there. It's real experience. So I didn't feel imposter syndrome with respect to the book. If I was a journalist or if I'm writing about someone else's story, you know, maybe it might have been different. And of course, you know, as I mentioned in academia, imposter syndrome is not at all uncommon, especially for women. Because it's very hard for women, especially if you're in any kind of a science field. It's very hard for women in these fields.
Mm. Were there any dark night of the soul moments with this book? Times where you thought, I don't know if this is going to happen?
No, because I had done all the work for it already. And it was never a thought that it wouldn't happen. I had set a very ambitious deadline with my editor, and it was mainly because I was on sabbatical. And I knew that if I didn't finish the book before my sabbatical ended, I'm going to come back and I'm going to be teaching and doing research. And I would never finish the book. So I really set this very ambitious goal. And maybe by setting that goal, it didn't give me time to have these dark nights. But I also should mention, you know, I've been in academia for a long time. Academia is very much geared toward deadlines. We have all kinds of deadlines. We have deadlines in writing papers, deadlines in teaching, deadlines in doing committee work and service. And we're just always, always managing deadlines. So we're used to that. So, you know, having this deadline where I had to deliver this manuscript by the first of the year was just another deadline, something that, you know, I've been doing my whole academic life.
Yeah, you've been training for this moment. Well, just a quick time check. We probably have time for about two more from Parul and I, but now is a good time. If you're listening and watching, I see a number of you already have. If you do have a question for Gloria, now's the time to put into the chat. And in a few minutes, we will circle around to your questions and give you a chance to ask them.
Hello, listeners. Just a note from us at the London Writers Salon. Our interviews are recorded in front of a live online audience. And so at this point in the interview, we turn to audience questions. Would you like to be a part of the live audience and ask your own questions? Head to londonwritersalon.com for more information. You can buy tickets to the online events or get free access to them as a member. Now, back to the interview.
So there's a number of people who are working on nonfiction books in our community. And one of the things that come up is the how much of your own narrative do you put into the work? And how much do you rely on the work? You're simply the messenger of the work. And I'm curious how you came to think of that, because the book starts out very much, we learn about you. Most of the book is then more data-driven and your work. How did you think about that? And were there any conversations between you and your editor around that balance?
Yes, a lot of conversations. So when you do academic writing, you learn to write very objectively. You never use the I. When you write, it's always very, very objective. And my editor and my agent wanted me to put more of myself into the book. That was very hard for me because I'm just not used to it. And, you know, my first thought is, why would anyone want to know about me? They want to know about the work. They want to see the results. But they told me that I need to express my motivations, why I decided to do this kind of research. And, you know, so it was hard, but as I started to do it, it became easier and easier to write about myself. And I began to use more of the I in my writing. And my editor kept urging me to include stories. You know, you must have stories. And as I started writing, I thought of more and more stories that I could put into the book. And I think now in retrospect, I could have written a book that was just simply very objective without any of myself into it. But I think it probably helps the reader relate to the studies better or the data better when they understand what my role was in it and, you know, imperfect being that I am and how, you know, the mistakes that I've made. And so I think my editor had given me very good advice to do that.
Yeah, I would agree. It was really nice getting to know you in the book, but also, of course, more here, Gloria. So thank you for spending this time with us. Other than getting the books, where can we stay in touch with you? Are you on social media? Any platforms we can follow you on?
Yeah, so I have a website, www.gloriamark.com. So it's my name, all lowercase. Please come sign up for the newsletter. You can find me on Twitter at Gloria Mark, I think it's _PhD, and LinkedIn, Gloria Mark. So would love to hear from you.
Great. We'll send all of that out. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Gloria. We wish you all the best. And yeah, thanks again. We'd love to have you back sometime. So maybe for book two.
Thank you for tuning in to the London Writers Salon podcast. If you enjoyed our chat and you'd like to join us for the next one, please visit londonwriterssalon.com for more information on how to become a member. As a member, you will have access to our interview archive, to our workshops, and our cozy online writing community. Whatever kind of writer you are, it is an excellent place to make new creative connections and focus on your craft.
And if you struggle to find time to write, you're welcome to write with us at our daily Writer's Hour writing sessions. It runs Monday to Friday, four times a day, and all you need is the desire to write, something to write with, and something to cheers us with. We think it's the world's best virtual co-writing space for writers, creatives, or frankly, anyone who just needs to get some work done. Visit writershour.com to sign up and join us. Until we write again.